What can people see in the house of a believer? Hello and welcome to Good Word. I'm Dave Thomas, your host, continuing on for another lesson this quarter, talking about family and the various rhythms or cycles of life that we pass through. The lesson this week focuses on the home of a believer and what might be seen there or what ought to be seen there. I'm glad to have my two conversation partners, Jen Ogden and Brant Berglund, colleagues from the Walla Walla area, one a pastor and the other a professor. And, you know, this is kind of a nebulous subject, but and yet it's an interesting one because it invites us to look inside a house, that when you look in a home, in a Christian home, in a believer's home, what ought to be there? What should your children see? And what should people outside of your home see? What should unbelievers see? So let's talk first of all about the people in your house. What should they see? Any ideas?
Well, if I can be just really shallow here, so many of the I think Christians think that their homes are going to look drastically different from an average person. If you walk into the average home, you're going to find the same things physically. So really shallow, you're going to find places to sit, comfortable, you know, beds. You're going to find artwork on the walls. You're going to find books. You're going to find
food.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to find a lot of similarities, right? And I think maybe that's the place to start. We have normal lives as Christians, and I think people who are non-Christians have normal lives, and so much of those rhythms of life are just the same.
Oh, yeah.
So let's not jump on board those, it's a completely different environment. Much of it is just the same.
Yeah, we still have to run water for showers, and we still have to take out
the... We struggle with whether the air conditioning is working when it's 105. Yeah, we have the same
things. So beyond the ordinary, what should be seen?
So maybe within that, some of the details. Okay, so if you look at the books on my shelf, you might find that the books on my shelf, many of them have a spiritual tone to them. That might not be the case in the home of a non-Christian, or maybe there'll be books of a religious nature in the home of someone who's a different faith, but there'll be a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think children should see in the homes they grow up in?
You know what I wish a lot of children saw more of? Is their parents enjoying each other.
Each other's company.
Each other's company, yeah.
I agree.
I don't think that a lot of children are exposed to their parents with positive affirming physical touch or positive words and really encouraging, almost bragging.
You're a failure of a child, right?
Like a husband and wife, spouses celebrating each other.
Instead of,
and I think in marriage, especially optimally in a Christian marriage, there should be that support and love around each other. And I wish more of our children saw that.
And backing each other up.
Yeah. I just think it'd be amazing.
So I wrote a few words: joy, openness, love, kindness, mutual support.
I would say the redemption, forgiveness aspect. We were talking about last week and the weeks previous about conflict. There should be a level of forgiveness that maybe isn't seen.
And the extension of goodwill.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to expect the best from you again.
Expect the best from me
exactly.
as well. Yes,
yes, yes.
Goodwill is a fascinating thing because it's actually something that you produce as a byproduct of a certain way of living. And it's produced when people do kind deeds without a hook or a hidden agenda. So when a husband brings flowers home just to say, I love you, goodwill, or when they cook a meal for each other or whatever, the goodwill is generated. And I think in households where there's goodwill, there's a lot of goodness. Yeah. I was thinking also of the nature of household operations. You know, people who study families talk about several characteristics, the rigidness of family structure. You know, some of them are very authoritarian and one person is in charge and you don't vary, and others are almost chaotic. You have no idea who's going to do what when.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so a family fits on that
spectrum somewhere.
Yeah. And the other one is the level of connectedness. You know, some people are so connected they can't do anything without consulting, and other people, they talk to each other once in a while when it's necessary.
Mm-hmm. But they're so independent, they don't have much interaction.
Yeah. And I still remember doing a wedding for a young couple, and she came from a totally chaotic family, and he came from a very rigid one where his father was the boss, you know. And they had some big struggles because it created a set of expectations where he was expecting his wife to be compliant, and she was thinking, what are you talking about?
Right.
She's just off doing whatever she does in her chaotic world.
Life happens, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the funniest thing to me, and sorry to bring up food again because we've been talking about that, but around mealtime was some of the biggest conflict because he grew up in a family where breakfast was at this time made by mother, lunch was at this time, and supper was made by mother again. And he went into a house where not only did we not know who was going to fix supper, we had no idea when it would be. And so, you know, this was
that would be tough.
They ended up ordering a lot of pizza. So anyway, I wonder, you have any comments about those dimensions in life? I think balance would be a very useful thing.
I think sometimes the traditions that Christian families have, I think like in our home, the Sabbath is very meaningful. And when Friday night comes around, things change in my home. But certainly, you know, Sabbath morning, we have food traditions that are special. We have worship traditions, right? Things that happen that you wouldn't find in a secular home because of what's meaningful to us. You would see giving bank account issues, right? Not all my money goes to secular pursuits. I give to my local congregation and I give to places that are sharing Jesus' love with the world. And so hopefully that's seen. I'm afraid that my children maybe haven't seen that as much because I do it kind of just
privately.
Yeah, quietly. And But they need to see it, I think.
You know, I want to switch this a little bit here to talk about the infectious nature of a good relationship. Mm-hmm. And you know, Ruth and Naomi come to mind. And, you know, Brent, maybe you can comment on that. You know, that's a remarkable story.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you have a Moabite in Ruth who shouldn't even be part of the community of Israel. They were disinvited, right? And yet Naomi, when her son dies, Ruth says, "Hey, I'll go with you, and I will join with your family, and we'll take care of each other." And that's a fascinating story.
And even your religion, your God, will be mine.
Yeah, maybe Jen, you can say more about this. This is a story that where women are the main characters, right?
So a rare treasure in Scripture. and I think the fact that the support of the mutual support of another adult and making sure that the decisions that happen in the household, such as a religious faith and those sorts of things, are discussed and chosen by those who participate in the household, that it's not a thing of force and it's not a
Naomi didn't force Ruth.
No, Ruth was willing to join.
What kind of person she was that she made her way of life and her belief system so attractive that her daughter-in-law, who was a social outcast, was so intrigued by it that she followed her and
not only that, but ends up marrying Boaz and then becomes part of the lineage of the Messiah. It seems important to me that story is in Matthew's genealogy to point out that relationship, that the somewhat scandalous nature of this Moabite is coming into the home of Boaz ends up being a type, a picture of our own.
You know, another story that comes to mind is one that's linked to hospitality, and I think that a good home that extends hospitality to people is very winsome. You know, I think all of us can think of occasions where somebody was gracious and invited us to home and fed us and cared for us, and we remember those occasions, especially if we were alone or somewhat destitute. And, you know, I think then of the story of Rachel and the hospitality she extended to a stranger and to think of the effects of that. Now, I don't think all hospitality results in a spouse, but the discovery of a spouse. But, you know, that's another biblical story that I think is interesting.
So maybe what you're suggesting is that our children should see us, you mentioned earlier, you know, especially the children, what they view, they should see us being hospitable, showing generosity.
Yeah. But not only our children, I think people outside should. And I know our colleague Paul talks about table fellowship that occurred in the early New Testament times where Christians would invite people. And there are other cultures, you know, where inviting somebody to your home is considered an absolute essential gesture. Mm-hmm. And that I think there's evidence that the gospel early on was transmitted by those kind of hospitable discussions.
You know? Well, and you've both shown your hospitality. I've eaten in both of your homes. You're both open to students. You're both open to community people, hungry people. And I think that goes a long way to say something about your Christian character. So certainly it's obvious.
Yeah. Let's talk quickly in a few minutes here about what do you do when you have a marriage to a spouse who's an unbeliever or of a different belief. Any comments? Because that does happen. And sometimes it happens because people deliberately get into those arrangements, or sometimes it happens because one partner changed or adopted religion when the other one didn't. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, because that can be very challenging, because religion touches on pretty much all aspects of life.
Well, Paul and Peter both have something to say. They both say you can leave, so just get out of the meeting.
Mercy.
The
option does seem to be there, interestingly enough. That if you are married to an unbelieving spouse and the unbelieving spouse is not interested in staying married based on your choice of faith and following Jesus, that certainly there is an open opportunity to
I always read that the unbelieving spouse was at liberty to walk away, not the believing spouse.
The believing spouse, Paul seems to say that in 1 Corinthians.
I'll have to go read that again.
The challenge there, though, is that Paul and Peter both seem to suggest that the ideal is for the believing spouse to stay with their partner, praying for them, hoping against hope that person
and
will
come
to know the gospel.
And they use the word that it will sanctify them?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, they do. I think missiologist Michael Frost speaks it well to me when he says that we should all live questionable lives. And by that, he's based that on 1 Peter 4:15-16 that says, and anytime anyone asks you the reason for the hope that you have in your life, always be prepared for an answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And always do so with grace and courtesy. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really important that our life leads people to question whether it is through hospitality. And that's, he says we should all be bells, right? We should bless others. We should be extremely generous. Yeah. We should eat with others, meaning we should be very hospitable. We should listen to others first and foremost. We don't know everything, and we should learn. We can grow from the world around us. And I think it's very important that we do all of those things. And I think in a Christian household, with the intention of sharing Jesus, we need to ring true to the gospel and do all of those things. Be generous, be hospitable, be listening learners.
Yeah. I would add one little thing here. I've noticed along the way that if there is a difference in religious belief, the new believer has a few opportunities to tell their story before the unbeliever, if I can put it that way, makes a decision for or against. And then you have to be very careful that you don't become an offense.
Mm-hmm.
Because repeatedly pushing your religion at them may create a wound that does not heal.
Yeah.
You know, you have to find a teachable moment or a moment when, as you said there, somebody is curious. Yeah.
I have a friend who was married for a long time to someone who is not a believer. He was recently baptized about 5 years ago, I guess. And she would get up on Sabbath morning and say, okay, I'm heading out to church. And he would, don't talk to me about church and don't yell at me, and for years, like 17 years, long time. And she never said, like, hey, come with me. None of that. Never once. And 17 years of long-term him feeling pushed and pulled, even though she never said anything.
Yeah, he felt that, though.
He was feeling the tug. He finally responded to it. Took a long time, a lot of patience.
And it makes you wonder what their marriage was like after that. You know, if she found in him then the partner that she had always hoped he would be, or if, you know, if there was then conflict in new ways, you know.
Maybe he became the partner he wished he was.
He wished that too,
yeah. Early on in my ministry, I knew the story of a woman who became a Christian. Her husband was not very happy, and he opposed her, but she went ahead anyway, and 29 years later, much to her surprise, he was baptized one Sabbath afternoon. He had gone and engaged in Bible studies with the pastor in secret because he wanted to surprise his wife.
Wow.
Oh, how sweet.
He said, prior to his baptism, he said to his wife that for 29 years I witnessed a quiet, consistent life and I finally could not war against it. And you persuaded me to become a believer. So that's, of course, a hope that doesn't always get realized. So
it's true.
Mm. Anyway, hopefully our homes can be places where there's joy and a good influence.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for participating, Jen and Brent. And our thanks to Brad Williams, our engineer, for the good word. I'm Dave Thomas.